Welcome to Bickerstaff Bickering, a show about democracy, markets, and machines for people who believe progress needs principles. To find more of us, visit thebickerstaff.com, where you can read all the articles and sign up to be notified of new content.
Okay. So you were telling me a story about this guy that...
Look, we don't have to put him on blast. Like, we don't have to name him. I have a friend.
Are you saying he's going to hear it?
I assume that everyone will listen to my podcast.
No one is going to listen to this one. Okay, a man who may or may not have a name that is two letters.
Right, yep.
That may or may not stand for something.
We'll
so,
each. Go ahead.
That's fair, okay? You know what? Okay.
That's true.
So you were telling me about this guy that some unnamed person in your family is friends with, and you were meeting this guy, and you were talking to him, and he's like a stock guy. You know, hearing this story, right, my opinion is this guy exemplifies everything that is wrong with capitalism, the market today. And you seem to at least take a milder approach. And so that's what we're discussing. So why don't you retell of BJ?
Yeah, so I've got this friend who comes to stay with me, and we don't see each other very often. So we're just catching up on life, etc. He made a good amount of money betting on Tesla years ago. He has like kind of a corporate office job for like a manly blue collar industry kind of thing. Is kind of a tech bro, listens to all the tech bro investing Silicon Valley podcasts, and is, you know, in that vibe. He's got the Tesla, he's got the Asian wife, he's got...
So he's not just tech bro adjacent, like he's all in on tech bro.
Well, he doesn't work for Google, right? He works for like a hardware manufacturer, a tool manufacturer. So,
well, Google is arguably a tool manufacturer as well.
So, you know, I guess my meta perspective on this is if you're the kind of person who bet on Tesla. My supposition about your investor psychology is that you are seeing the ocean, seeing the waves crashing on the beach, and you're just getting on a fucking surfboard because you know that other people think that this stock's going to fly. And like the SpaceX IPO just happened, and it IPO'd at $142. And it went up to like 215. It like doubled in price in like 3 days. And now it's like 150 now, right back to where it started, basically. And my analysis of that situation is there's so many, the vast majority of market activity is not people who believe in the underlying fundamentals of the company, but believe that other people believe that other people believe in the underlying fundamentals of the company. So there's like a 2% hardcore believer. There's a portion of people who think, I like this thing. I like that it's happening. I like the man who's in charge of it. And I want to like support that. Like it's a vote somehow. And they're not even thinking about the price. So there's that category. And then there's a group of people who are betting on that group of people to push the price up. And then there's a group of people who are doing some kind of financial analysis and actually think it pencils out to where a price to earnings multiple of 400 makes any kind of sense.
Okay,
and then there's a group of people betting on that group of people.
So first we're going to discuss like, okay, the people who think that it pencils out. Pencils out how? It's a serious question to me because I think if you talk to just regular salt of the earth people about the stock market, like they basically say something akin to, Well, the stock market goes up. And you're like, okay, well, what does the stock market going up mean? Like, why is that something that you make money off? And they're like, well, the price of the stocks goes up. Like,
yep.
Okay, sure, yeah, right.
Average 8% returns over the last 100 years. It's a pretty good track record.
Yeah, well, okay, but there's quite a few spikes in that, right?
So, right. Sometimes it's plus 27, sometimes it's negative 17.
Right. So let's take that first cohort, because I think they're like arguably...
So, no, I would say that probably forms your base there, because that's all the what they call the passive flows that... And this is why it's so important to be in the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ. When you get listed in those major exchanges, like, you just automatically get money. You have an infinite
right.
bid that just shows up because people shove money in their retirement account. The money
right.
gets dispersed across all 2,000 stocks in the NASDAQ, and it just keeps coming. So that yeah. is, like, one of the biggest important factors about the way the modern stock market works. Is that so many people have their pensions tied up in this. But go on.
These hedge funds, these money market funds, right? They're just like, there's these big funds that they put money in the stock market. I certainly wouldn't call myself a power investor, but I'm aware that there's like all these different funds, but a lot of them are based on, well, the line goes up and to the right. So these people that they're like, oh, it pencils out. Like, what pencils out?
So when you get down to a person who thinks it pencils out, like, this is a person who is aware of the future discounted cash flows model. They probably have never run one and don't fully internalize what it means. But they recognize that, like, the company has to make more money than it's making now to satisfy this price level. And they are aware of the concept of the total addressable market, the TAM. So TAMs are like very hand wavy. With SpaceX, ultimate TAM is maybe based on, well, they're going to go grab an asteroid full of gold someday and bring it back to Earth. And then everyone will be a trillionaire. And it's like, well, that's not how anything.
It's kind of my point, right? When someone buys SpaceX, that is a company that has made almost no money. You can check me on that. It might be literally no money, right? It's very little profit. They made some very cool rockets before. That's all well and good. I want to be very clear. They have not delivered on any serious promise. We're going to be on Mars, you know, in 2023 or 2024, and then it's 2026, and then it was 2027, and now it's 2020.
Just give the genius time to work, Lucy, first of all. The total addressable market value of Mars. Have you thought about that?
Right. That's fair. Okay, you got me. If we get to Mars, well, there's no one there, so there's not really a market. What will we do? Well, we'll ship people there. And what will they do there? They'll build a habitat, I guess, which will cost more money.
Spend money to make money, Lucy.
We start making money here, right? Sure.
That's yes. the beautiful part.
So for the people who bought SpaceX, what I want to ask them, and I'm kind of asking you as their proxy, is when does SpaceX start making money? Like, what does it make money
for? SpaceX is a really weird business because it's actually at least three core businesses. It's the Starlink that does actually make money. They launched all these satellites and they sell internet services mm-hmm. and it's profitable. It's like, okay, if that were a standalone business, you could do some reasonable calculations about here's how much money they make today and here's how much money it costs to maintain the network and here's what we think the market value. They're the only operator available for internet services in some contexts, and so they have pretty good pricing power in those situations. All that seems pretty good, but that's like a tiny part of the overall
right.
company. So then you got the rocket business, and you go, okay, what is the addressable market for space launches? The U.S. government, obviously, they like launching things into space. End of list? Like, I don't know, the odd celebrity who wants to go to outer space for a few minutes. So a lot of business is storytelling, obviously, and what Elon has accomplished is mostly storytelling. He is selling this idea that we're going to put data centers in space. Data centers are a huge attractor of capital investment right now.
But that's a horrible idea. You cannot do it. Okay, you cannot do it. Like, anyone.
Yeah, but what if you could, Lucy?
Knows anything about thermodynamics knows that vacuum is a horrible conductor of heat. You can check me on that. It's horrible. The only way you can dump waste heat in space is with radiation, which requires a massive amount of surface area, these very fragile fins. It is a horrible idea. And if you're going to put $100,000 of your investment money, maybe you could look and go, oh no, actually, this is not a thing that makes any sense at all. Because you can't get rid of waste heat in space without enormous amounts of water.
I will admit I'm a little conflicted and hazy on what's going on there, because you're right. Like, the reason that they make vacuum sealed bottles with a barrier that is nothing more than empty space that is meant to insulate is because a vacuum is a great insulator and not a great dissipator of heat. And that's what space fundamentally is. So that seems bad. And then you've got the problem of radiation shielding, because electronics are very sensitive to radiation. And lo and behold, space is full of it. So you got to solve that problem by lead shielding? But then is that helping your waste heat problem? I don't really know what's going on here. Everything that I understand about physics is telling me this is a bad idea, other than it's relatively easy to get 24/7 solar power once you're in space. That's good. It doesn't matter how much surface area you take up. You could put giant solar panels and always direct them at the sun. So that's helpful, but the first two problems seem debilitating to me. So
Right. Yeah. Those problems are debilitating, right? Obviously, someone could go, well, you could do this and that and work around it. And it's like, yeah, probably. But does that make this whole thing worth doing?
Right. Is it all up to this is more economical than just building a data center on Earth? I mean, launching things into space is also tremendously energy intensive, shall we say?
Right. So, it's all very, very expensive. So I look at this and I go, where is any money at all being made? I don't understand. Like, how does this make any sense at all?
Well, hold on, because there's a third leg to the business here. This is the one that makes up 80% in their SEC filing, but really it's XAI. That is the core of what they are proposing in their IPO documents to the SEC that is going to be the revenue driver for the whole thing. XAI, fourth or fifth best US AI company, that is, projected in their own filing to be the revenue driver, because the total addressable market of intelligence is practically infinite. Somehow something everyone pays you money when you build AI, even if you're fourth or fifth best.
Well, okay, so the steelman case here is that these people, these first layer of investors, are going, well, you know what, putting data centers in space doesn't really make any sense at all. So that's not worth anything on my balance sheet. And then we go to the Starlink, which, has a slow, steady income. So then we're at AI, right? And so these people are basically saying, I'm putting it all on red, or I don't know, red odds, red blue seven. I don't know how this works, but basically,
using a roulette metaphor. So yes, it's red or black. You get a payout of 2 to 1, but yeah. Your odds are actually slightly worse than 50.
Can you put it on? Can you make your bets more granular? Right? Can you be like?
Yeah. You can bet on a specific number.
Right.
Or in a third of the wheel.
Okay. You can do like 1 to 10, right? So, you know, we can go back and forth on what the odds of, you know, the fourth rate AI company taking over the world is, right?
I mean, Anthropic looked like it was well behind OpenAI, and lo and behold, now they've overtaken them in possibly valuation. Upsets and surprises can happen. But when your entire founding team left the company and you're this far behind, it doesn't seem like a great bet to me.
So we're still going with the steel man argument is, look, I'm putting my money on their AI, right? They're going to be a player in the AI space, which is, you know, fine if you're making that claim, because we got to get to, like, what's the next layer of these people? So let's say all these people who are penciling out, like, they've decided that AI is it, and they're gambling on AI.
And in fairness, it's the only big public AI company you can buy right now. Well, maybe Microsoft and Google, I guess. But it's such a small portion of their businesses that it's harder to make that case. But you can't buy Anthropic or OpenAI is my point.
So I'll tell you why I think we have to look at something different, because I don't think anyone knows what's going to happen with AI. It really could just be something that's so transformative that maybe the bet is worth it, right? At some point, buying a lottery ticket does pencil out. So I want to back up to stick on the general point of what are these people thinking, right? Let's keep with Musk. And go Tesla, right? Tesla makes almost no money. It has like a massive stock price. So the people who buy Tesla, what do they think is going to happen, right? Do they think that Tesla is going to sell all the cars that are sold in the world?
Do you make robots too?
Not until recently, and they're not very good. So we're not going to count robots.
There's a phrase that everyone trots out at this point, which is, okay, the market is forward looking. It's all about dreams.
There you go. All right. I'm done making my points. The point is, it's all on dreams. I have a hard time seeing how it's anything but pure speculation. Like, this company might do something great. No one is going, oh, yeah, look at this PE. Tesla has a massive stock price, made no money, still makes almost no money. They made the Cybertruck. It was shit. They've been promising self-driving, and yet people still buy Tesla, right? And your guy made money on Tesla.
Right.
What is going on here that this system works? And is it sustainable? That's what's interesting to me, right? We have this system, a company that breaks promise after promise after promise, right? We're going to have full self-driving. Oh, we're going to have Tesla taxis. Oh, the Cybertruck is going to change trucks forever. The truck is horrible, by the way. It rusts. It cuts people's hands. It has no storage space. It's a horrible thing. And
yeah,
yet...
stainless steel rust. The whole point.
Yet, right. I don't understand why. And to someone who isn't a stock market bro, it doesn't really, like, how can they keep going? How can the value of this company keep going up when it doesn't do anything? It's not good at anything. And yet people still buy it.
Let me hit you with a fact and see how this lands. I'll start with a little bit of narrative first. So like, Procter & Gamble is a very boring company. Frito-Lay. Baltimore Gas and Electric. Like, these are very boring, predictable businesses. that are going to earn exactly X amount of money. You can almost pin it within $100,000 next year.
Yep.
Because you know what the customer base is. So they're going to run marketing at this rate, and they're going to sell this amount of product. Probably not a lot is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
So they trade at price to earnings multiples, and price to earnings here means you divide the stock price by how much the company makes in earnings, and that's what your number is. So if a company has a PE multiple of 10, you're paying $10 a share of stock for every $1 that they make. They trade around, you know, 2 to 5. And the Magnificent Seven, so-called stocks, this is the Silicon Valley darlings, Apple, Nvidia, Microsoft, Amazon, Tesla, mm-hmm. Google, and Meta, make up 32.5% at a lower bound on any given day of the entire S&P 500. So seven companies are a third of the top 500 companies by market capitalization. And the reason for this is because there's a dream there, right? People think that something will happen, something amazing will change, and these companies will ascend to the heavens. They don't believe that about Procter & Gamble or Frito-Lay. But they believe that about...
We're going to lock cold fusion, but it's going to require a massive amount of corn chips. And only Frito-Lay will be ready to really take advantage.
And so that's why the stock market is largely storytelling. It's, you know, these secular religions almost around what the future may hold and what dreams may come of these companies' fortunes. And you have to really kind of cast around for explanations of what's going on here, why Google trades at a PE multiple of 30 and Tesla at 340. It's a little mystifying. If you do like normal financial analysis, you look at this company, you say they make this much money, the stock costs this much, so I can expect that they will do X things with that money in the future. Maybe they will give it to me in dividends, or maybe they will invest in future businesses that make even more money than they're making today.
Uh-huh.
Whatever you think they're going to do with the money, you're expecting something amazing to happen if you're buying a PE multiple of 30 even, much less 340. So yeah, it's all storytelling. And another thing I think that's a background factor here is, what else are you going to put your money in? You look around the world and... Yeah. Europe's economy isn't amazing. The Middle East, Southeast Asia, full of corruption. China's hard to invest in. South Korea and Japan, they have aging populations.
So we're all doing this because we don't have anything better to do.
Right. There's a little bit of, well, what else am I going to do with it?
Okay.
And that's a class of investor that is also in the mix here, that's just buying Google because everyone else is buying Google. There's a lot of reasons why we're in this situation. It seems unsustainable to me too, because not all of these dreams can come true simultaneously. What else are you going to do with the money? You're going to shove it in treasury bills? You're going to buy gold? Bitcoin?
Here's the thing. So I get what you're saying, like, what else are you going to do with it? But who knows what the world would be like if people didn't do this? It's hard to speculate on what the world would be like. But, you know, if everyone said, you know what, I don't believe that Tesla is gonna be worth it, right? I don't believe that Tesla is worth it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put this money into these developing country funds where, like, they give small loans to people trying to start businesses in developing countries. And so what if everyone just did that? Like, what would the world be like if everyone just did that? So the idea that you can't do something else with the money, you know, maybe if there was more infrastructure in place to support that, maybe it would make more than the S&P, because it's a lot easier to bring people up from making $1 a day to $10 a day than it is from making, you know, $100 a day to $1,000 a day. If I'm working at a McDonald's in the U.S., I probably have access to clean water, basic healthcare. You know, we can argue about how the U.S. healthcare is broken in some ways, but basic healthcare, basic sanitation, basic nutrition, I probably have access to those things. So it's harder to bring me up. But when I don't have access to those things, it's pretty easy to bring someone in sub-Saharan Africa, to bring them up to the level of health, education, nutrition, where they can then be a productive member of global society. So the question, to circle back there, is what can you do with it? Well, there's something you could do with it. And why don't we do that? What is causing people to not do that? Why isn't everyone going, let's slam it into this developing country fund because it does almost as well as the S&P and I believe in it?
Yeah, no, it's a fair question because the population dynamics also matter. And a lot of the countries that you're pointing to have younger skewed populations. And we know that that's a factor in lifting an economy. You've got all these people with ideas and dreams about things they're going to do in the future. Yeah. And so 10Xing a business in Nigeria seems kind of easy. You just do something that people want and boom, but.
And the thing the people want is like fresh water.
There's fairly obvious things on the table to be grabbed.
Yes, I realize there are highly developed, you know, portions of Nigeria, but in some places it is just fresh water. In some places it's decent food, and in some places, right. No, it's a little bit higher, right? Like internet access, right?
But what you run into is the buzzsaw of corruption and lack of rule of law and weak property rights generally.
Like, is there so much corruption that we can just throw the baby out with the bathwater because the baby's bad too? I don't know. That's the analogy here.
If you're an investor who's just looking for a return, you're highly sensitive to the possibility, at least, that you could be expropriated at some point. And if you're in an index fund in one of these developing countries, then your risk is spread around and every company is going to get upside down with some politician and a couple of them will. And so that creates a drag on the whole fund. I don't know. Again, the population dynamics and other things make it so there's a lot going for that kind of situation where there's a huge greenfield space to grow into to just build the Walmart of Nigeria versus 10Xing existing American Walmart. Like that seems absurd. Not going to happen because there's already a Walmart everywhere.
Right. That's where I put my money and it's making money. Yeah. It's not making as much as, well, it's making more than SpaceX, if you depending on what you buy. So, but it's not making as much as some other things. But I just meant that as an example of what if everyone looked at the world differently and said, I can make about as much I'm making and then not be gambling or not gambling as much because you're still gambling, right? So in your example, the business that I made a loan to runs into a corrupt politician. I think that's a good point. You made that point. Also, you know, Donald Trump could decide that actually this company is a threat to, you know, state security and, oh, does that sound like anything? We're not exactly that far
Yeah, I think people underestimate that risk, right? Like, America is also now a sub-Saharan African country.
Right.
At least from a corruption level perspective, like that's where we're at. And we haven't fully grappled with the fact that that's a risk vector. I think we're all just pretending like that's not happening.
Oh, that's a good strategy.
It's really hard to move people's baseline expectations. And I think most people, most of the time, just think, well, that won't happen to me. That won't happen to my investment.
Yeah.
And we're going to need consistent evidence over time that no, in fact, the whims of the dictator actually determine the fortunes of your company. I mean, NVIDIA just saw this with Jensen Huang going to supplicate to the Mad King and being able to sell GPUs in China that were export controlled before. So, to
And it
some degree, it
worked.
works both ways, right? Corruption can help your company too.
We took a little tangent on where else you could put your money. I stick by that because I think you could put your money there, and I think it would make the world a better place. I get your argument that's like, well, that's not really practical to ask people to think that way. So the question is,
It's also that some of those products are just not as accessible. Like they're not front page of Fidelity.
yeah.
You have to work a little to find how to invest in the Middle East or Southeast Asia or Sub-Saharan Africa. What you get are generally Europe and East Asian friendly democracy funds or the US. That's it. You know, like Latin America doesn't even exist. There's investable things there, but they don't have as big of economies, so they don't drive economies of scale in the same way. But yeah, returning to why is the Mag 7 a third of the S&P 500? It seems unstable to me, right? Like we've got
Right.
a one-legged stool, and that's
Stool.
scary. You can sit on a one-legged stool. The question is, should you?
Sit
And
on the stool.
if you find yourself on a one-legged stool, what should you do?
All right. All right.
Because it's already kind of a fait accompli at this point. Like most people have their 401ks tied up in the S&P 500, which feels like diversity. But lo and behold, you peel back the covers and you're like, wait, there's just fucking seven companies in here.
Right.
And they're all doing basically the same thing.
They're all doing basically the same thing, right? And so are we like kind of Looney Tunes, Wile E. Coyote, like we're running off the cliff, and it's just like, well, we're not gonna look down because as long as we don't look down, we won't fall.
I will say, like I saw a lot of doom posting last year that
Okay.
people were
I'm like a
grappling
doom post.
with this fact that the stock market was becoming increasingly concentrated, that all growth was coming from either healthcare or AI investment. Like those are the only two things in the US economy, at least, that are growing. And people were getting scared increasingly. And
Yeah,
then
seems
nothing happened.
reasonable.
Nothing happened. We went forward another year and the stock market's at all-time highs again and again.
Yeah,
And we got
so.
into a war with Iran and oil spiked, but not that much for opaque reasons, mostly because China released much more strategic reserve than we realized. Yeah, like it's just, there's so many factors to account for when you're thinking about how the future economy is going to unfold. It's really hard to keep in view the totality of it. And we're definitely in a place of, I think, unwarranted complacency, where too many things have to go right in the future for everything to turn up roses. And it leaves the discerning investor in a very uncomfortable place where none of this makes sense, but it is what's happening.
None of it makes sense, but it is what's happening.
I grew up in a day, Lucy,
okay,
where businesses produced goods and services and people paid for them and they made money for investors on that basis. We don't live in that world anymore.
Yeah, it does seem that way, doesn't it?
I remember reading that Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway, his company, pulled like 40 to 50% of its money out of the market and basically just parked it in treasury bills,
mm-hmm,
and said, none of this makes sense. This was last September, August timeframe. There's nothing investable in the U.S. economy, they were saying.
Yeah.
So we're just going to stuff it in T-bills and wait for the inevitable crash and then pick up the pieces like we always do. And they've kind of been mocked for their lack of appreciation of the strength and industriousness of the U.S. economy.
What
I don't think
US
anything
economy
about the this has changed, though.
Like,
it's producing hope.
Yes, I would agree. I would agree that hope is a considerable strength of ours. But like, it does seem like AI is still not quite making any money. It might soon. We don't know for sure. I don't know.
Well, so a couple things. Like, the total global GDP produced by white-collar work is about $19 trillion. So if you assume a maximal success of AI and it takes over every white-collar job, never mind that would cause revolutions. It doesn't, just put that aside.
It will be the end of civilization as we know it, because you have a bunch of angry white-collar people who, despite what MAGA wants you to say, when they can't feed their family, they're going to get violent.
Okay, but put that aside for a second.
All right, put it aside. Put it aside.
There are predictable negative consequences of every white-collar worker around the world losing their job, but let's assume there weren't.
All right,
so they can make $19 trillion. It's a lot of money. We're acting like the impact of AI will be even bigger than that. So then you have to assume, okay, they don't just do that. They also do robotics and start doing blue-collar work too. I mean, this is where you get into what we're speculating is there's going to be perfect abundance, and somehow we'll also come to a political compromise that will share all of that across everyone to keep everyone happy.
There's
kill
perfect
each other.
Abundance. Why do I need to address it in the stock market?
Good question. Yeah, sometimes people frame this like you're inside the exponential, so nothing makes sense because everything's accelerating around you so rapidly that there's not a place to stand where you can get a view that gives you insight into anything meaningful. Everything is about to change. If you take that view, it still begs the question, okay, but like, what do I do with my money? maybe just spend it all now because nothing matters. Robots will do everything.
The thing about AI that I find very confusing is, what's your end? Like, how do you think this ends? Where you make a ton of money, but also that money matters. And we're back to talking about AI, which I think is one of those things where it is hard to not talk about AI, right? Let's be real. It's hard not to talk about AI because who knows, does know what's going to happen with it, right? It really could be society altering. Are we all just going to hold on until AI either fixes it all or...
Well, if there's one thing that's for certain, it's that you can only live life in the present at 1x speed. Unfortunately, there's no fast forward. There's no time travel. And so you've just got to make the best decisions you can. Right. I mean, there is a strong attraction in my mind to the idea that that you just got to go with the vibes. Like, I don't know what to do here. The future is so uncertain at this particular moment in history that there's no clear applicability of, and this is what the market is telling us too, like, your old models of, oh, companies have to make money, that's out the window. Quit being silly. The rules are different now. That's what the PE multiples of the Mag 7 and the general demeanor of the stock market is telling us. There is a strong possibility that all of this just comes crashing down in 9 to 18 months. And we're like, what were we thinking? This was all clearly ridiculous, but it might rebound as we make breakthroughs in whatever scientific areas and bend the laws of physics that we didn't know existed until AI told us they did. It's all very confusing, is I guess what I'm saying. There is certainly historical precedent for criticizing everything that's going on and saying, this is tomfoolery. This time was not different. Everything we know about economics, down to physics, still holds. And you all have been behaving very foolishly.
Well, that's it for this Bickerstaff Bickfest. The folly continues, but reason endures. Until next time.